On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with alternative media investigative journalist James Corbett.
It's black and white that there were various aspects of the Osama bin Laden raid myth that were demonstrable lies. And so, for example, I mean, it occurred on the 1st of May, 2011, and immediately there was a narrative created that was bolstered in no small part by the image of Obama and Clinton and others in the White House taking a look at presumably the live video footage of the raid itself. But that was contradicted, for example, just 3 days later on the 4th of May by the fact that there was, in fact, a blackout during the time of the raid. So there was no visual footage. So there are all sorts of things related to that story that we know that were, in fact, demonstrably untrue. But it was interesting for me to watch how people, even people whose opinions I respect and who I think are generally quite cautious about the way that they approach these types of situations and this information, just sort of immediately took it on faith. Okay, this is it. This is a raid. They got Osama. If politicians can come out and say whatever, X, Y, Z, and we'll just take it as an article of faith, then I think that's a sign of a very, very unhealthy democracy, isn't it?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to talk about the process of waking up, that is, the personal paradigm shift that we go through when we encounter new information and it winds up penetrating our worldview and changing it. And this is a process that we've talked about, and I've talked about my personal journey through waking up with regard to consciousness, extended consciousness, survival of consciousness, and that's been much of what this show has been about for the last 165 or whatever episodes. But there's another kind of waking up process that I've gone through and I've talked about on this show, and I want to explore again in today's episode of Skeptico, and that's related to this question of how can this be? How can this be true? And how can I, as an intelligent, well-read, interested person, how could I have not known about this? And that process of not knowing and then knowing and going back and going, how was I deceived, is a process that's led me to ask broader questions about the systems of power and control that shape what we think we know and the sources of information that we have for getting it. And that leads us to today's show and today's guest, James Corbett, who is a podcaster and an alternative media journalist. I think James's work is great, and I really enjoyed this conversation that I had with him. Here's my interview with James Corbett. Today we welcome alternative media investigative journalist James Corbett to Skeptico. James is the host of The Corbett Report and a popular guest on a variety of alternative news outlets. James, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me here today. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we'll see. I think we're going to have fun. As I explained in the email, the connection between your work and the, you know, personal paradigm shift that you went through has a lot of connections, I think, with some of the work that we've done here, but I guess we'll have to leave that up to the listeners. A couple of times I've tried to make these connections with folks who are doing stuff in what is commonly called the conspiracy theory area or the truth movement, and some folks get it and some folks don't, but I see those connections so often that I just have to kind of return to them again and again and see if I can bridge that gap and figure out if there really is that connection. So I'm looking forward to talking about that with you.
Well, me too. And I certainly understand the work you're doing in trying to resist a dominant paradigm in a different field. And I think there is definitely a lot of resonance between this work, because obviously we're both up against an ingrained institutional bias. And I think there's a lot of points to be made about what that bias is and how best to overcome it.
Great. And I think that's one of the connections we'll make. Maybe a couple others too, but we'll get to those in a minute. I think what we should probably do to start things out is introduce you to our audience, and there's no better person to do that than you yourself. So, James, tell us a little bit about your background, about the Corbett Report, and the other investigative journalistic activities that you're involved with right now?
Well, my name is James Corbett, and I'm a Canadian. I was born in Calgary, Canada, and I lived in Alberta, in Canada, for most of my life. And I went to university in my hometown of Calgary. And eventually I went for my master's degree at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. And I spent a year there, and that was an incredible experience. And after that point, I was looking for something else to do. And one of my friends in Ireland suggested teaching English in Asia. So I thought that sounded like a good idea. So I started looking it up online, and I ended up coming to Japan. So I've been in Japan now for about 8 years. And it was about 5 years ago now, actually just over 5 years ago, that I started encountering the information that eventually spurred me to create the Corbett Report. I started encountering all sorts of information related to 9/11 that I had never encountered before through any other outlet. And I started encountering that on YouTube, but then I started looking up documents and things for myself. And when I had convinced myself that there was something to some of this information, I decided that the incredible discrepancy between what I was seeing represented on TV and through mainstream media outlets and what I was finding online was just so great that I think I felt compelled to add something to that. So I decided to start my own website, which is something I had never in my life considered I would ever do. And from that point on, I've been producing the Corbett Report. It's a podcast and a radio show, and I do interviews and articles and videos. And I've been doing that for 5 years now, and it's a steadily growing enterprise, one might say.
Great. I think I remember hearing in one of your podcasts where you're introducing you and your background that you were, like a lot of us, myself included, completely unaware of any kind of conspiracy idea behind 9/11. I mean, you were just kind of bouncing along many years after 9/11, just thinking like the rest of us that, yeah, that's just the way it happened, the way we were told, right?
In fact, not only that, I was quite resistant to the idea that there was anything, any kind of conspiracy behind it. And it was just one of those things that I think maybe struck a nerve with me, that when people raised the possibility that there was something to the story that we weren't being told, I almost wanted to not hear it, because it was just so disgraceful and disrespectful to the people who died that day and all of that. And I had, I think, the usual types of emotional turmoil and stress and resistance to that idea that a lot of people have. So I certainly understand when people first start hearing about this and they don't want to hear it. I certainly understand that. And that was the place that I was coming from. And as you indicate, it was 5 years after the events before I really started taking a look at the information that showed that there was something else to the narrative. So certainly I was resisting for quite a while before I finally started to take a look at the information for myself.
You know, it's funny because it was even longer for me. And I remember, you know, I was just doing my Skeptico thing and investigating alternative science and ESP and near-death experience and that kind of stuff. And that led me to, really, it was pushing up against skeptics and finding out that they were so consistently, uniformly wrong, deceptive, and over-the-top aggressive in their illogical, non-critical thinking, that really kind of drove me to say, gee, if they're wrong about this, what else might they be wrong about? And I think I started with the JFK thing, you know, the JFK assassination. But back to your point, I can remember specifically after investigating JFK for quite some while and, you know, really immersing myself in a lot of books and a lot of documentaries and all that information, I remember talking to my wife and saying, you know, I think I have my handles around this JFK thing. And clearly it was not, as the Warren Commission said, and clearly it was a pretty deep conspiracy inside the government. But that 9/11 thing, I remember saying, I can't buy that. I just can't believe that went that far. So one of the things I wanted to have you tell us a little bit about is your personal experience with that paradigm shift. And I love the way you describe your paradigm of being this left-right political thing, and that there's this left and there's this right, and I'm on the left, and that's the paradigm. And then that kind of gradually faded away. Can you tell us about that process?
Well, that's exactly right. So I have always been a politically interested person, not particularly political, not really involved in politics per se, but always interested in politics. And I like to consider myself as an informed individual who kept up with the latest information about the political situation in Canada or in Ireland or wherever I was living at the time. So in that regard, I would be following information through mostly mainstream media outlets and, of course, into the internet age, starting to take a look at some internet sources. And so it was in 2006 here in Japan. It was just a pretty mundane event for me, actually. I was just moving into a new apartment, but the apartment came with an internet connection, and it was the first time I'd had internet in my apartment for a few years. And in the time that I did not have that internet connection, suddenly there were these new things popping up like Google Video and YouTube and places that were basically, I mean, anything that you wanted to take a look at or wanted to browse, you could suddenly just type it in and it would be there. And it was kind of an amazing thing for me at the time. And so I was immediately, through my left-right political filter, I was on the left side of that political spectrum. So I was looking at the types of sources online that you would expect a good liberal to do, I suppose. I was watching, you know, The Daily Show and things like that. And it was through that process, actually, that I started to encounter in the related videos section of YouTube that I started to encounter these 9/11 videos. And I would click out of them just out of interest. And a lot of them would be ridiculous, but some of them made points that actually made me decide to pursue it. And you're exactly right. It was through that, through that, and then following that even further into the central banking system and how that's run and things like that, that I started to really break through that paradigm. And it's only, I think, after having done that, after having gone through that process, that I realized that the left-right spectrum really is a paradigm and that there are other ways of looking at the political universe. I don't think I realized just how limiting that was. Or how convenient it is, really, that basically the population can be divided almost in half or roughly in half and set against it each other when the average person that I encounter and meet and talk to on a daily basis has much more in common with me, regardless of whether they be on the left or the right end of the political spectrum, than some, you know, Soros or Buffett or some, you know, multi-billionaire. I mean, that's plainly evident, and yet we can be more prone to attack the people that we encounter on a daily basis because they don't belong to our side of the political spectrum, as if that's the entire political universe. So when I finally started to break through that and started to gain some perspective on what that political spectrum is and how it functions to keep our society divided, mm-hmm. is when I started to really, I mean, step back and see the system as it exists as a whole. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing to me is that it's one of those things that I guess I can become accustomed to the idea that there is another paradigm. There is another way of looking at politics. It doesn't have to be about that left-right spectrum. So when I see the mainstream discourse always and invariably reduced back to that left-right paradigm, it absolutely blows me away that people still see the world in that way, because I don't see the world in that way anymore. So I look at that discourse and I think, well, there must be a lot of people who believe in it, but I just don't see it that way.
See, there is a clear parallel that we're going to have to try and make this connection here, because I started out Skeptico and I was interested in investigating, I guess, paranormal is the stuff that it fits into, but really kind of human consciousness issues. And I got into it thinking, okay, there's this honest debate. You know, there's these folks who are skeptical of it, and there's these folks who are believers of it, and there's some scientific data. And if we just follow the data, we'll get to some kind of resolution on it. And what I found is the data really stacks up just on one side of the debate. And the debate that was there was really anything but honest. You know, there were these researchers that were pretty much just kind of following the rules and being honest, but they were being swamped by this other group that seemed to have a variety of agendas in this skeptical camp that were really playing a different game, almost like a political game that I was seeing and that I thought we were removed from because we were in science. So I got a real kick out of listening to one of your shows as you were describing the early episodes of the Corbett Report when you were, I guess we'd have to say, naively exposing people to this data with the idea that, wow, you know, once they understand the facts, everything will change, you know. Once we get this information to the mainstream media, of course they'll want to get this out. It's like the retort that you hear so often from the skeptics. Well, you know, why wouldn't someone just win the Pulitzer Prize or write a bestseller to cover all this stuff? And of course we know that the system is designed specifically to prevent that. But we do, I maybe you can relate your experience with that. But I think there is that enthusiasm that I think you had, and I know I had, that, gee, if we just follow this data, if we just get this data out there, everything will change. And then now I'm kind of at a different place, but maybe we can talk about that in a minute. Maybe you can talk about that early phase for you and what that was like.
Well, ultimately, I think I still have to believe, I still have to have faith that people are able to discern the truth from the fiction, and that they will, once presented with the data, actually eventually make the right choice. But certainly, I think the idea of placing our trust in the system itself, the establishment media and places like that, to be the venue for the dissemination of this information would be hopelessly naive. I certainly don't put my trust in that. But that's why I think the internet has absolutely changed the course of our politics forever. I mean, there's no way that genie can be put back in the bottle now that people can really circumvent the entire institutional system that's been put in place to really limit people's access to this information. And in the scientific paradigm, I mean, there's obviously the scientific journals and things like that, but most people access that literature through the science media, which obviously has its own ingrained biases. In my case, it's a very similar situation. Obviously, politics, people usually access the political world through newspapers, through TV or whatever. But now that there is this internet paradigm and people are finding more elaborate ways of circumventing all of that institutional bias, they can directly communicate the facts to the people. So I know that it is still an uphill battle, but I do have faith that the average person, when presented with the data, we'll see that. And so I see the role of people like myself in this to be the person presenting that data. And everyone will come to that data with all of their baggage and preconceptions and all of that type of stuff. And eventually, I mean, one hopes that enough data will eventually convince people to get over those biases. But I understand also there are other people who just have a harder time busting through that paradigm. And again, I'm not exactly sure what makes someone able to or less able to question their own assumptions and preconceptions, but there is some sort of calculus at work there in the psychology that makes people more or less susceptible to really challenging their ideals.
I think that's an interesting point, and I find myself engaged in this debate, if you will, with folks who are on my side of these issues that I care about, and that's that, you know, is there this paradigm change? Is it coming? And is it imminent? You know, and they'll point to various books and articles, and really in our case, what we've kind of focused on a lot lately is the survival of consciousness, and in that certainly there's a lot of very mainstream, respectable people that have kind of come forward and come on that side of the camp really overwhelmingly. But I still think there's this problem in both cases, in your world and in my world, of living in the bubble a little bit and not realizing how hard it is to bring people over, and maybe underestimating a little bit the systems of power and the systems of control and their influence. And I really have to wonder if those are lessened by the internet, or whether, as we see, you know, there's just this effort to kind of put the genie back in the bottle through whatever means necessary and not let things move in that direction. Let's take for a minute your world and talk about it for a minute. Let's say you wanted to make the case that the government is lying about the death of Osama bin Laden. Well, all the evidence is just overwhelming on your side. I mean, I think you could make that case, and maybe you can give people a thumbnail sketch of what that evidence is. Not that you know specifically what happened, because I think that's always a trap that we fall into, but just the simple fact that the government is lying and not telling us everything. The evidence seems overwhelming. And yet I have to tell you, in just encountering people day to day, when I float that out there, I don't get a very welcoming reception. I mean, unless it's someone who I know is preheated for that kind of outlook, that kind of paradigm. Are we really making that progress? I mean, this is Osama bin Laden death was really, really one of the more poorly done of these charades that's been pulled off. I mean, if that doesn't penetrate, is there really a lot of hope that we can bust through that disinformation that gets peddled out there?
Well, that is a particularly interesting example, isn't it? Because that is something that is so in your face. I mean, it's black and white that there were various aspects of the Osama bin Laden raid myth that were demonstrable lies that were coming out in the hours after that raid. And so, for example, I mean, it occurred on the 1st of May, 2011, and immediately there was a narrative created that was bolstered in no small part by the image of Obama and Clinton and others in the White House taking a look at presumably the live video footage of the raid itself. But that was contradicted, for example, just 3 days later on the 4th of May by the fact that there was, in fact, a blackout during the time of the raid. So there was no visual footage. That iconic image of them sitting in the White House Situation Room looking at the video feed is, in fact, not them looking at a video feed at all. Who knows what it's actually a picture of? But that came out a few days later. The initial indication was that Osama had fought back, that there was some sort of running gunfight, but as it turns out, there really was no gunfight at all. There was the initial indication that he was using his wife as a human shield, etc., but eventually they had to admit that didn't happen. There was the entire saga of the helicopter crash, etc. So there are all sorts of things related to that story that we know that the initial reports that were coming out were in fact demonstrably untrue. But it was interesting for me to watch how people, even people whose opinions I respect and who I think are generally quite cautious about the way that they approach these types of situations and this information, just sort of immediately took it on faith. Okay, this is it. This is a raid. They got Osama. And my initial reaction is the way that I try to be with most events is, okay, well, that's interesting. Let's see the data. Let's see what happened. Let's see the evidence. And when the evidence started to not emerge, and it turned out, for example, of course, they dumped his body at sea immediately and they'll never release the photographs. I mean, to anyone who's watching that with a skeptical eye, I think they understand, well, we have to reserve judgment until there's something more than that. I mean, if politicians can come out and say whatever, X, Y, Z, and we'll just take it as an article of faith, then I think that's a sign of a very, very unhealthy democracy, isn't it?
Well, in this case, James, we even had more data, if you will, than that. I mean, this is one of those cases where the worldwide media through the World Wide Web really kicked in. I remember watching interviews with Feet on the Street right there with the neighbors in Pakistan who said, hey, I own the house next to it. So I immediately ran down there to see what was happening. And another guy was on his rooftop, saw the helicopters. Other people knew the person who was in the house. So, you know, we actually saw, and I'm sure you did too, these interviews with people who live there and directly contradicted the story that were being peddled, and that didn't seem to penetrate, and it certainly wasn't at all covered, again, by the mainstream media in any way. So again, back to this question, what does that say about this idea that, you know, the little soldiers, the long tail alternative media on the internet is going to change things? Well, we sure didn't change things on that, and that was a real whopper.
Well, but then how do you know about that information? Because you saw it on the internet?
Right. I saw it on the internet.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, the point is that we're not going to see this reflected in the mainstream media. The point is that we're going to encounter this information on a more personal level. And the problem with that is that there's no real rubric. There's no way for us to measure or calculate that effect because it's happening on a personal level with people personally accessing this information. If it was the type of thing that was being portrayed in the mainstream media, we could say, oh, it's on the front page of the New York Times, you know, X million number of people have read this, and it's sort of part of the cultural record, so to speak. But because this is something that is so diversified and so individual, and that there's really no good measure for getting a handle on how many people are accessing this information, how many people saw this, how many people know that piece of information, it works in the way that people tend to become compartmentalized in their own minds, insofar as no one knows anymore. We don't have that cultural background that people even 20, 30 years ago would have. If something was on, you know, a mainstream network, you could be safe to assume that half of the people you talk to would probably know about it. I mean, it would be water cooler talk. We're reaching an age where it's become so diversified, the media has become so diversified through the diversification possible by the internet, that we don't have that cultural context that you can be assured that everyone will know X, Y, or Z. Or it's becoming that realm of the shared cultural knowledge is dwindling. But again, I see that as actually a progress. I think that is actually something that's helping to free minds from that cultural paradigm. And also, I mean, I think that indicates that there is much more of an awakening, if you want to use that word, happening than will ever be portrayed in the mainstream media, obviously. But it's things like that you encountered that information of those interviews through the internet. I'm talking to you from my home in Japan, wherever you are, and broadcasting to wherever the people who are listening to this are through the internet. I mean, I really do think that this is a fundamental paradigm shift in the way that society communicates, the way we receive information, and the type of information that we receive. And I go back to it time and again. I really think this is the Gutenberg printing press revolution of our age. And the Gutenberg press, I mean, it took a century or so, but I mean, it eventually led to the Reformation and some massive, massive changes in European society, and eventually, of course, over the globe. And I think we are just beginning to see what the internet is beginning to do to human consciousness. And I really do expect that it will have as monumental an effect as the printing press did.
So you're optimistic. That's great.
I would have to say I am optimistic. I think there will inevitably be a reaction. And also, I mean, just because there's a new form, a new media, a new way of disseminating information doesn't mean it can't be co-opted. I think the printing press was great because it opened up literacy to the masses. And suddenly people could have direct access to these texts, including, of course, the Gutenberg Bible and all of this, that they would never have had direct access to. They had to encounter it through the clergy, and basically they didn't even understand what was happening because the masses were in Latin and all of that. So the Vulgate Bible changed people's consciousness, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a wonderful, profound thing. But of course, immediately, what does that lead to? It just leads to the development of new forms of propaganda and new ways of trying to control that new medium and basically control what people see in that. So I have no doubt there will be reaction in against what's happening right now on the internet, and it will not be a straightforward trajectory. It won't be a simple narrative of people inevitably breaking down all the dams that have been put in place for centuries. I think there will still be a lot of fight back, but at the end of the day, I am hopeful that people are reasonable, they are rational. When they encounter overwhelming amounts of data, no matter how much baggage they're bringing with it, eventually that absolute windfall, that waterfall of information will wash over them and will change the way that they see the world. So I think I do have to be optimistic on that point, because otherwise I probably wouldn't be doing this at all.
Okay, well, good. I'm going to try and jump in and grab some of that optimism too, because I'm not totally pessimistic of it. I just think the agents of non-change, the agents of maintaining the status quo, are much stronger, much more pervasive than we at first think they are, you know, because that's the other part of this onion when you get into it, is not only to see the reality of the non-truth, but also the systems behind what maybe really is the truth, as close as you can get to that. And I'm talking in maybe an abstract way, but one of the things I want to talk about is the skeptical community. And I just listened to an episode you did recently about skeptics, and particularly about Michael Shermer, and I found it interesting. He's been on the show. We've had many, many skeptics on the show, and I thought maybe you could recap what you've found and what are some of the observations about the skeptical movement that you'd make.
Well, I did, in fact, catch your interview with Shermer, and I think it's particularly telling that correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I assume that the reason that he appeared on the broadcast was because he believed that it was going to be something skeptical in the sense that they use that term.
You know, you want to talk about early podcasts. That was podcast number 2. And I don't think it was it was so much that he thought it was a skeptical podcast as it was that he was following up with Professor Rupert Sheldrake from Cambridge, and he had some familiarity with some of his theories. So
I see.
That is so long ago, though, James. That is so long ago. for me that I can, I have to cringe when I think about the interview with Michael Shermer.
Yeah, well, I would love to hear a more recent one. I think you'd probably have a lot to say to him, and I'd love to hear that. But I doubt he would agree to that at this point. But I reserve a special place in my heart for Michael Shermer because of his particularly egregious affronts to logic and reasoning, which are absolutely displayed everywhere in his writing when it comes to the quote-unquote conspiracy world. But specifically, I mean, there are such ridiculous examples of poor reasoning that that absolutely just, I guess, push all my buttons. For example, in the Huffington Post back in December 2010, he published an article, "My Day in Dealey Plaza, Why JFK Was Killed by a Lone Assassin," in which I guess he presumes to be able to put to an end basically 50 years of research and debate and the millions upon millions upon millions of words that have been written about the JFK assassination by this, six or seven paragraph article, in which basically the sum total of his argument is that he went to Dealey Plaza, he stood in the spot where Kennedy was shot and looked up at the book depository building and saw that it wasn't as far away as he had thought. Therefore, it is not necessary to invent additional assassins to explain the assassination. Therefore, LHO acted alone in killing JFK, QED. And he actually ends with the quote, "erat demonstratum," as if he had proven a point of some sort. And that particular article was just so galling to me that he would presume to be able to solve all of this, you know, 50 years of debate about what happened in Dealey Plaza by simply going to the place and assuming, oh, well, okay, it's not far from the window, therefore it was LHO acting alone. And there are so many different parts to pick away from that, which I do in my podcast episode that you mentioned there about the skeptics. But that one was something that got me thinking along these lines. And certainly I've encountered not only Shermer, but many, many other self-proclaimed skeptics who use similar tactics and logical fallacies, which in most cases, logical fallacies employed by people against conspiracy theories don't really get on my nerves, don't really agitate me, because most people don't really even understand what it is they're doing. But clearly someone like Shermer, who has written extensively about logical fallacies and how they're employed and given examples, right, etc., knows what he is doing when he employs a logical fallacy in trying to back up his arguments.
Right.
So it's the dishonesty of it that really particularly galls me.
Right. I'm sorry, just let me interject here, because I think this is what I wanted to get to with the skeptics, because I wonder if it goes beyond mere dishonesty. And I'll throw in an example from my world that I think is interesting, and maybe we'll be able to make a connection for people who don't know. But one of the instances of this dishonesty we can point to in the near-death experience research is Michael Shermer, in his column in Scientific American, and he felt obligated to report on a piece of research published in The Lancet by a guy named Dr. Pin Van Ommel, who is a well-respected 20-year cardiologist who published really a kind of monumental research on near-death experience. Shermer, in his article, completely not just distorted the article by Van Ommel, but got it exactly the opposite. So Van Lommel's conclusion is that there's no conventional medical explanation for this conscious experience during a time when there's no brain activity, quote unquote. And Shermer wrote the opposite of that. It so incensed Van Lommel that he felt a need to publicly reply and say, look, you got it wrong. And of course, that led to what on the part of Shermer? Nothing. No retraction, no restatement, no correction, just march on and not change the position. So is the dishonesty really at the level of this willful ignorance or ingrained belief system? Or when you really stack it up and you start looking at the positions, the strange positions really that the skeptical community takes in defending the status quo across the board on every, it really doesn't matter what political party is in office or in control, it's just defending the status quo and defending a certain set of values that seem to be central to running this whole system that we have. It makes me wonder if there isn't something else going on behind that whole movement. And I don't mean that there's a group in some smoky room that makes all these decisions, but just that in the way that we see these things work, there's a nudge here, an opening of door here, a wink and a nod there to really kind of push an agenda. And I wonder, I have to wonder, and I have to really believe that some of that is going on within the skeptical community. What are your thoughts?
Well, certainly my sense is that there are members of the skeptical community who are absolutely working towards an agenda, and I wouldn't want to indicate otherwise, but it strikes me as a similar thing to what we deal with, for example, in the 9/11 truth movement, where the evidence of a cover-up could be either a cover-up of malfeasance or a cover-up of misfeasance. I mean, it could be someone covering up something that they did wrong, or it could be someone covering up something that they did, period. And that's not really decidable just from the fact that there is a cover-up of a certain piece of information. You can demonstrate the cover-up, but you can't demonstrate the underlying reason for that. In the exact same way, or at least in an analogous way, I think when you look at someone like a Shermer or whoever who absolutely invariably defends the status quo even to the lengths of uttering absurdities and absolutely refusing to look at information, et cetera, et cetera. Either that is because they are just so set in their ways in terms of defending the status quo that they don't want anything to challenge it, or they are actually working to an agenda to actually bolster that status quo. And I think that's not really decidable from the fact that the person is employing those things. I mean, again, I don't want to speculate on that. I mean, I have no doubt that there are certain people who are doing that, but I'm not here to speculate on who is employed by who or for what purpose. That to me is not particularly the point of this. To me, the point is not to argue with someone like Shermer per se, but to show the people who might be interested in listening to what Shermer says that, hey, he's employing logical fallacies here. He is lying to you. He's not looking at this information, et cetera, et cetera. Or anyone, you know, take your pick, not just Shermer, but just as an example. And I have faith that the people who are looking at that as the audience will understand that. I'm not really interested in arguing with these people individually, because either they are so set in their ways that they'll never change their mind, or they are working towards some specific agenda. Either way, I don't really have any delusion that I'm going to really change the minds of one of these self-proclaimed skeptics. I'm really looking more at their audience and trying to show them that, hey, you're being taken for a fool. Why are you listening to what this person is saying?
I am too, but I guess I'm also hitting this second wall, if you will, that comes up when people object to this data. And I know because I was there myself, and also I have enough friends who run into this wall, and that's the how can that be question, you know? So you get hit with the data, whatever the data is, you know, Osama bin Laden, you know, why would they bury him at sea? Why do we have these reports, all these contradictions, all these changes in the story and the falsified photographs, all this stuff piles up, and you hit him with that. And I can see it in my world when you hit them with somehow in some way we don't understand consciousness does survive death. And in both cases, what I see is wheel spinning. And the wheels are spinning not about the data, but about almost at a subconscious level. What would this mean to me if my worldview had to shift? And how could that be that I could not know that? I'm a successful person. I'm a good person. I have a nice family. I drive a nice car. I have a good job. I read. How could I not know that? So I do feel obligated to push a little bit into understanding those systems of power, control, deception, misinformation, and exposing those a little bit. And even if I never will know completely, I have to nibble around at those edges, because I think that's the objection that really a lot of people are run into. And that's that, okay, I can't really absorb the data until I can kind of understand that the underlying paradigm that I have about how the world works isn't really accurate. Do you see where I'm going with that?
Oh, absolutely. As a philosophy minor back in my university days, I go back to my, you know, philosophy of science 101 with Thomas Kuhn, and the idea of the paradigms, the idea that was, I think, revolutionary for his time when he was formulating this hypothesis, the idea that the arc of science and scientific progress and discovery is not one of just a straightforward building upon of information. There are, in fact, rupture points in science where the discrepancy between the data that's coming in and the old paradigm, the old way of thinking about the universe was just so great that something had to give, and eventually everyone switches over to the new paradigm. Of course, we can take a look at all the historical examples of that, switching over from Newtonian mechanics to Einsteinian relativistic mechanics, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the point to that is that there certainly is a point to which people can delude themselves that there is still a way to cram that data back into the box that they're currently in. And it comes down to a certain level to the personal psychology. And I don't want to psychologize this because I think that's a tactic that is increasingly employed by skeptics to assault people, certainly in my community, I imagine in yours as well, that these are people who are, you know, searching for some sort of answer. And so thus they must connect everything into a conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera. So they tend to psychologize it. But I think there is an element to which personal psychology determines the amount, I suppose, of cognitive dissonance that people are able to put up with, the discrepancy between the information they're getting and the way that they can handle that in their left-right political paradigm or whatever paradigm they might be in. So I think we have to take a look at what that is. And I'm not sure there is a one-size-fits-all solution for ever putting this data across in a way for everyone. I think everyone has their own way of encountering this information and working with new information and eventually busting into the new paradigm. But I think there must be a breaking point at which the vast majority of people, I imagine, are in some ways, in some key forms, unconscious actors in at least one realm or other. So, for example, I work in the political realm. I think there are a lot of people who kind of get their political understanding as from osmosis, just from being in the culture and interacting with people on a daily basis, who don't necessarily have well-defined political ideologies or beliefs or understandings, but that kind of seeps into them through what they encounter and what they read and who they talk to. And I think there must be a point at which a certain percentage of the population is talking about and understanding politics in a different way, that paradigm will shift, and the people who are just unconscious actors and just learning by osmosis, as it were, will switch over into that new paradigm. And I do believe in that type of shift. But again, when that cultural shift will come, if we may not already be on the cusp of that type of a cultural shift, I'm not to say. I really can't say.
More of that optimism. Great. We need more of that. And I really am an optimist. So I love to hear that. Tell us this. For someone who maybe has their interest piqued a little bit about this, what's a starting point? What's a way in to your world? Obviously, the Corbett Report is out there. I'll just say that, you know, I've always told people, start with JFK, you know, because it's far enough back that it seems to be a little bit removed, and the data I really find overwhelming. But I have to say, that really hasn't worked for folks. It doesn't work. They're just not interested. What do you tell people who maybe this hits a chord with them and they're interested in exploring this crazy world that you're talking about? What's a good entry point?
Well, I think you hit on the key term there, is they're not interested, or what are they interested in? And I think that really is what it's about. I mean, people can only ever approach a new paradigm from what they find interesting in that new paradigm. So if people are interested in JFK and what happened there, or they think they'd like to know more, that would obviously be an entry point for them. Perhaps it's 9/11. In my own personal story, for example, I mean, it was 9/11 was one of those events that there were a lot of things that I was willing to think about before I encountered anything about 9/11. For example, JFK and things like that. I thought, well, that's interesting. I didn't know a lot about it, but it did seem very suspicious to me. But I didn't bother to really go into it too much. It was 9/11 that got me interested in taking a look at this information for myself. And interestingly enough, I think from my own perspective, once I started to really break through that door, that barrier that was holding me back from taking a look at the information, and I started to encounter this, and I started to put pieces together and realize that there were so many problems with the official account of 9/11 that something had to be amiss. The thing that I think actually really busted down my old paradigm and got me into what I'm doing right now was, in fact, something completely or substantially unrelated, which is the concept of central banking. For my mind, being the type of person, the thinker that I am, I could see that there were all sorts of discrepancies in the 9/11 story, but I thought, how could it possibly function? How could something like this happen? And when I started to encounter the information about the central banks and how the Federal Reserve creates the money and puts money into the American economy and who controls the Federal Reserve and things like that, that was really what started to get me thinking along these lines in a serious way. So again, I'm saying this is going to be different for each individual who's encountering it, but I think you have to follow your interests and you have to be not afraid to look into the data for yourself and to really challenge what you're seeing and reading. I never, ever, ever expect people to just take what I'm saying for granted. I always hope that they'll be looking for this for themselves. And again, that only comes from my personal experience, but I know that I could hear, you know, people saying things like this and giving me points of data all day long. But until I'm actually invested in that process of taking a look for the information and trying to sort it out for myself, I don't think I could ever really accept anything. I could never take it on board. And I think that's ultimately the next step. Once people are interested in the information, once they start reaching out for it and looking into it for themselves, that's when I think the real paradigm shift can happen, which is why, for example, in my podcasts and everything I do, I always try to put the source links to the documents that I'm talking about so that the interested people, the people who have never heard of something before, want to explore it further, can go and take a look at the actual source document and decide for themselves whether or not to take that information on board. And once again, yes, you keep coming back to it. I guess I am optimistic fundamentally because I know in my own case it did work. I actually started to bust down those barriers that have been keeping me back. So I know it can happen, and I wish there was a one-size-fits-all solution for people out there who are interested. All I can say is follow your interests and the things that you find fascinating about this, and be prepared to challenge what you thought you knew.
Wonderful, James. And I don't think you could have given a better advertisement for the Corbett Report that I really hope people will check out, and you'll get exposed to this very open, fair-minded approach that you take, which I think is very refreshing. So if that little bit that you gave us there didn't pique anyone's interest, I dare say your interest cannot be piqued. So please, I hope people do check out your site and the various places that it can take you, because you have many different outlets for the work that you do, both the Corbett Report on YouTube, your radio show. There's many, many outlets for it. It's been wonderful having you on Skeptico. Any thoughts before we let you go?
No, I guess just on that note, I'd like to once again stress to everyone that part of what I've been talking about today is the internet and how that's helping us to break through the paradigm. But that only works if people get involved in it. So one thing that I always stress to my audience is that I'm no one special. I'm just a regular guy here in Japan who encountered some amazing information and wanted to share it with others. So what I do is nothing special in and of itself, and it's something that anyone out there can do. So if you have a particular topic that you are interested in and that you have something to contribute, I say get into it with all your heart and soul and energy, because that is truly what will affect the change that we want to see, whether it's busting down the walls of scientific establishment, academia, or politics, or whatever it is. If you don't get invested in this and actually put your energy into it, I think the world will be a sadder place for not having that in it. So I always encourage people to get involved in this themselves and start rolling up their sleeves and doing what work they can and what work they have to, really, to try to spread truth and information to other people.
Well said, James. That's wonderful. Well, thanks again, and would love to follow up with you and see where your journey takes you and reconnect sometime. So we'll have to make that happen as well.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to James Corbett for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, if you're still listening to this podcast, then I think we have much to talk about, and I hope you join me on the Skeptico forum to discuss some of the issues around this topic. I guess the first would be to get really specific. Do you believe Osama bin Laden was killed in a U.S. raid in May 2011? And if you do, why do you believe that? What evidence do you have? Why do you trust the sources that you trust on that? You know, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton just came out this last week with an explanation of that iconic Situation Room photo. Maybe that does it for you. Maybe that's the final proof that you needed. Or if you don't think that's solid evidence for the death of Osama bin Laden, why don't you think so? Another question I'd have is, what about these systems of power and control that I alluded to? How prevalent are they in forming our opinions, both of world events, political events, but also in science and in the culture as a whole. And a related question would be, how do these systems of power and control work? Are they all highly organized? Is there a master plan and a few folks who set the agenda? Or is it more of an invisible hand of self-interest grabbing for what they want that morphs into a direction that we all seem to follow down a path? Well, those are some of the questions I have, but I'm sure, as is always the case, you'll have more and you'll have other areas that you want to take this discussion. And I look forward to seeing what you have to say, either in comments on the Skeptico website, emails to me, or of course on the Skeptico forum. If you're new to the Skeptico show, you might want to check out the Skeptico website. It's at SKEPTIKO. Don't forget the K. And there, as I mentioned, you'll find links to all our previous shows, an email, Facebook link to me, and all that good stuff. Now, I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I hope you'll stay with me for those. I hope you'll tell your friends to listen in to Skeptico and share whatever you think is worthwhile about this show. Well, that's going to about do it for today on Skeptico. As always, thanks so much for joining me. Take care. Bye for now.